What I want to do today is transfer the ideas that came from particle motion using path integrals to gauge theories. So one is we imagine an action for a gauge theory that is some background, expanded about some background gauge field. Like so. So this is a background gauge field of some kind. And we're going to, if we did not look at fluctuations about that background, but just looked at the background, this is non-zero if S of A bar is finite. So we're not interested in backgrounds that give infinite values to the classical action. So a bit of notation. We're in Euclidean space, and the T's will obey these commutators without an I, and I'm summing over the C. TA dagger is equal to negative TA because we're in Euclidean space. U of X is equal to E to the lambda A of X, TA. There's no I up here. Again, because we're in Euclidean space, this is a group element, and the trace of TA TB is equal to a half delta AB. You can always choose the generators to have that normalization, sorry, minus a half. And the gauge field will be contracted with the generators like so, and I'm going to bury the coupling constant in the definition of the gauge field. And so we have a field strength, F mu nu, which we've seen now a number of times, is given by this structure here.
The choice of the generator as being anti-Hermitian, what does it have to do with Euclidean space?
It allows you to develop proper convergence properties for the background Euclidean action. And so when you analytically continue, this goes into I times itself. But basically, what it does is allow for a full Euclidean space formulation where the classical action converges. It's not perhaps immediately obvious, but when you grind out the action, which will be minus a quarter, the trace of F mu nu, I can leave everything downstairs because the, because of the G, I've got actually that thing. So this is 1 over 4 G squared times the integral d4x, excuse me. So it's the integral of d4x, f a mu nu, since f will be proportional to a t, then you take this trace and the minus a half makes that into a plus 1/4. So a gauge transformation is a mu getting changed into a mu plus d mu sandwiched with a UU inverse, which will force F mu nu to go to U F mu nu U inverse. And what we want is this condition. We want SA bar finite, which means this gauge field strength has to fall off at a certain rate. And if it goes like 1 over r squared, this will be 1 over r to the fourth, so this will be log divergent. So it the gauge field has to fall off faster than 1 over r squared. And unless you want to imagine it's falling off like 1 over r to the 2.1, the next integer in line is 1 over r cubed. And this means that the gauge potential has a fall off like 1 over r squared up to something that goes like UU inverse, which will not affect the gauge field to this order, by which I mean if you write each component of the gauge potential like this with that part, the UAU inverse part will get canceled off in the large R limit being suppressed by this, and the U d mu inverse will only ultimately just have that effect. So this is as R goes to infinity. This is the large R limit. One gets that. And so the group element itself is actually a function of x hat, where x hat mu, this will work provided the group element has this fall off where x hat mu is really the angular variables in Euclidean space. So in other words, you can imagine looking at this thing at some large finite R that is fixed, and the field strength will have the fall off condition of 1 over r cubed, provided the gauge field does this, and these things don't depend on the distance out at large enough r, of course, but rather just on the three angular directions in the four-dimensional Euclidean space. So this will guarantee the action is finite, and we can have a U for that action. But of course, U is not unique. If I let's do another gauge transformation. If A prime is equal to H A plus D mu H inverse, then this tells me that U prime, if you like, or rather U, goes to H U plus terms that fall off fast enough that they don't matter. So if I do a bona fide gauge transformation on A, where H is some other group element, then in this large R limit, U will change by this much. This will give you an H d mu H inverse. And the other terms will fall off fast enough that they don't matter. So if H U equals identity as R goes to infinity, then you could just get rid of the u d mu u inverse term as r goes to infinity. So in other words, naively, one might say, why bother with this silly thing at all? I can just kill it off by a gauge transformation, provided this is true. Yeah.
Why do we not consider the effect it had on A? Are we getting a...
Well, it'll affect what this looks like. But what I'm concerned about is what that looks like.
Okay.
So I'm not saying it doesn't affect A. I mean, it will, of course, the form of this term will, of course, be modified like this. But this, the part that goes like this will be modified like so. And it's that part that I want to draw emphasis to, in the sense that if you, if HU, so one might think, well, look, since this happens, why don't I choose H to be the inverse of U, and then I'll just get rid of this, and I don't ever need to worry about that term. But the problem is you can't do that. This is not possible in general. And so the value of the action is actually characterized by a group element at infinity in a certain way. And let's start with a 2D example, 2D Euclidean space. And U1, which will mean T is equal to I over 2, say, so that T is, T dagger is negative T.
I'm a little confused. You said that the behavior of the action at infinity is governed by this U, W, U inverse term?
Yeah.
But, I mean, the action is invariant.
Not when you do the integral, that's what we're going to see. So it turns out, if you put this in here, we'd think, you'd think, bear with me and you'll see how this works out. The value of this is going to take on some classical value that depends on that, and this will actually percolate into the answer because you're going to get an integral. What you're going to get when this term comes in is there's actually an integration by parts required to show the invariance, but that integration by parts knows about this term, and you can't get rid of it. But we'll see, I think, in the example. So U1 is, where was it? U1 is the group I want to consider. Let's let lambda equal to 2 theta of x. And I'll have f mu nu equals, now I can do 1 over r squared, because I'll have a d2x instead of a d4x. The action, did I write it down? We have s is equal to the integral of the trace, what is it, 1 over 2g squared, the trace of f squared d2x. So 1 over r is not good enough, but 1 over r squared is good enough. I'm not going to let it fall off by some fractional power. And so the gauge potential in general is 1 over r plus u inverse du, where now we have an abelian group. So u, of course, is just equal to e, when I have that generator, e to the I theta of x. So what U does is it maps, I'll call this theta of x hat. X hat, there's only two dimensions now. X hat mu is x mu over r. But what it means is I've got a disk, the boundary of a disk is a circle. So these coordinates are the xy coordinates, but stuck to a circle. Yes?
I think I'm a little confused about the scaling.
Sorry?
I'm a little confused about the scaling.
Yes.
So in 2D, we expect that the field strength scale is 1 over R, right? This is something different. You say?
Well, what I said was, if there's two Fs in here, if F goes like 1 over R, then at large R, this is going like 1 over R squared, and that is going to get killed off, possibly, let's see, there'll be a dx dy, so you'll get a d, if you go in polar, you'll get an r d theta, and you'll get r over r squared, which is a logarithmically divergent term, and that'll just get killed off,
right?
Because by S of a bar will be infinite, and it won't make any contribution to the path integral.
But we know what that
means. So, sorry?
But we know what that means.
Well, it is, but we want to look for particular E's and B's that have this property, that it falls off like that. So just be a bit more patient, and maybe it will, I hope, become clear a bit later. So this thing depends only on the angle of a circle, which means that U1 is a group that is valued on a circle, but it's mapping coordinates of a circle into a circle. So x hat is basically theta, the polar angle, and this is getting mapped into whatever that polar angle is. Maybe I should call it phi to remove confusion of that, where phi belongs from, or varies from 0 to 2 pi. So this is a map from S1 to S1. So the possible U's, well, I could have the identity, or I could have a phi, sorry, and I could have e to the I phi, and I could have U2 is e to the 2 I phi, or I could have, in general, e to the N I phi. I called it nu, I guess. Nu I phi, where nu is some integer. This is the most general map of this type. So this is trivial. This just says take the identity. This is the usual definition of U1. But this is like what one might call a double cover of nu1, of U1. And this is an n-fold cover. This integer nu is called a winding number. So if you imagine a circle as a line segment where we identify points, so a circle, of course, is this, but I could imagine it to be a circle is equal to this with this, where these two are identified, right? Just take a string and glue the ends together. Then what happens is here's 2 pi, here's 0. This thing maps everything into a point. This is what U0 does. U1 is a one-to-one map on the line. Everything gets mapped into a point, because it's just one. So here's U1, and here's S1. Here's S1, here's U1. The group U1, I don't mean U at the value of one. So, and then, but another part, can you see if I go down here? No? All right, well, I don't want to raise an entire board, so I'm going to cheat and go over here. So the third possibility is that, or the next possibility, the third possibility, I guess, is that now I've got a point. The bottom point goes here, but the pi point goes up to here, and this point gets mapped here, and then this point gets mapped to here. So in other words, you're mapping the circle twice in 2U1. This is what U2 does. So in other words, half the line segment gets mapped into the entire circle, and then you map the other half into the circle yet again. So the idea is, what I'm trying to show here is this thing, this segment goes into the entire circle, and then this second segment again goes back into the entire circle. I sort of, that's the idea of this picture. So the bottom half is mapped here, and the top half is again mapped here. So that's twice wound around, and in general, you could do this many times. Just chop S1 into new segments and then magnify each one into a circle successively, and you've wrapped it around N times. And one way to think of it is take your arm with an elastic band and just wrap it once, twice, keep twisting the elastic band, wrap it around as much as you like until, of course, you constrict your blood vessels and destroy your hand or something. But that's basically the idea. So we classify all the possible maps of U1 into the circle with nu. So different functions have the same winding number if they can be continuously transformed into each other. And we say, in that case, those things are homotopic. So so if f of x goes to g of x continuously, then maybe I should use phi to be clear on that, then f and g have the same winding number nu. And then we say f and g are what we call homotopic. To each other. So alternatively, we can invert the problem and say that nu is I over 2 pi times the integral over, let's say, d phi of u d by d phi u inverse. So if you give me some u, we can do that. Let's actually check this. If u is e to the I nu phi, then u d by d phi u inverse, of course, is just equal to minus I times nu. And so the integral from 0 to 2 pi of d phi times I over 2 pi of u d by d phi u inverse is obviously equal to I over 2 pi times this integral of minus I nu, and that just obviously gives nu. So in other words, if you don't know what the winding number is, shove it into that formula and it will come out. And furthermore, so that's good. Now, suppose u goes to u plus some deformation of u, then u d by d phi u inverse, one can show, goes to minus d by d phi of u inverse delta u. Or maybe I should say plus this. So in other words, if I deform u on both sides and put this in, then I obtain that, and so new is unique. In other words, if I infinitesimally deform this in some way, then I get the same new for the deformed U as I do for the original. Maybe it's better to put a prime in there, and then I can have equal signs. So it's also additive. And you can use this logic to do the same thing, that if you take the product of one winding number, of a U with one winding number and a U with another winding number, then the total winding number is the sum of the two, which, I mean, should be, I hope, pretty obvious. Just so U nu of phi looks like that. If I take the product of these with two different nus, the exponentials add together and the winding numbers add together by that definition. So now what happens here is this formula has another interesting property in that if I write it down again, this I can regard as the limit as r goes to infinity of I times 0 to 2 pi of r d phi over 2 pi times a sub phi based on these fall-off properties, and then this thing here is equal to I over 2 pi times this same limit as r goes to infinity of 2 pi d phi, r d phi, r hat mu, epsilon mu nu, a nu, which by Gauss's law is equal to I over 2 pi times the integral of d2x d mu of epsilon mu nu a nu, which is I over 4 pi times the integral of d2x times epsilon mu nu of f mu nu. So in other words, nu is calculable in terms of the field strength. Yeah. What do I mean by which?
That nu is unique.
Well, then if I take, here the function is obvious, but suppose you give me some function that maps a circle into a circle. I don't know what it is. What this tells you is if you make a small local change, a small infinitesimal change to the function, such that this can continuously go to zero, both this one and this deformed one have the same nu. You can't make a small change of a map from a circle into a circle and change its winding number. You have to actually multiply it by a function that has a different winding number.
Okay, and then so the total derivative then vanishes.
Yes. That's right. This total derivative will vanish because of the name. When you integrate this, maybe I should have said that. You're right. When you integrate, if I take the integral of this, I'll get a new prime. If I take the integral of this, I'm going to get nu. If I take the integral of this, I'll get the value of this at 0 and 2 pi. But because of my assumptions about this, this vanishes at those endpoints. If it didn't, it wouldn't be deformable to the identity. That's my requirement, and then that's what makes you unique. So conversely, if this delta U has some non-trivial winding number, then that won't work. But I assume that delta U is deformable back to the identity. It has to have the same value at 2 pi as it does at 0.
Yeah.
So I guess another way of saying it's unique is to say that it's a topological invariant.
That's right. Which is what this basically is showing here. This quantity is obviously completely U1 invariant, no matter how many winding numbers you've got. And because of the boundary conditions, if you work it backward, it works out to be that. So that's right. Yes, that's right. So the point is, even though A mu is literally going to a pure gauge transformation as R goes to infinity, if it's in two dimensions, you can't remove it. There can be some property of this abelian gauge field. Well, in fact, this abelian gauge field at large R in two-dimensional Euclidean space will have some winding number attached to it. And so A is classified by nu, its winding number. So you can have some gauge field that is like two-dimensional electromagnetism locally, and if you went to Euclidean space, you might think, well, okay, it's just the Euclidean version of that. But in fact, these A's are not relatable to one another globally, because one of the A's could have a winding number of 3, and the other could have a winding number of -7. All right, so then the non-abelian case, there is indeed an analog. So let's start with SU2. And here, U will equal e to the minus I lambda dot sigma over 2, which I could always write as A plus I B dot sigma, where the sigmas are the polys, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, I, minus I, 0. I always forget whether the minus is up or down. And 1, 0, 0, negative 1.
It's up.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry?
I think the minus I is usually in the first row.
In the upper right, you're saying. I've got it here in the lower left, but that might be because I've Euclideanized it. Is that sigma x, sigma y should be I, sigma z. Yeah, so it should be there. You're right. Yeah. Sigma x, sigma y. So this times this will give an I. This times this is a minus I. So it'll be I, sigma z. Yeah. Okay. So u dagger u is 1, or the identity, which says that a squared plus b dot b is equal to 1. That just follows from the Pauli matrices, where A and each of the B's, of course, are real numbers. Well, this is S3. So really, these are the coordinates. They're real numbers, but they're the coordinates of S3, because this is the sum of 4 squares. So just the way x squared plus y squared is a circle, w squared plus x squared plus y squared plus z squared is a 3-sphere. So what u does is it will map a 3-sphere into, well, if we're in Euclidean 4 space, it's going to map it into a 3-sphere at large R. So u maps S3 into S3. And so what happens is now the analog of that winding number is X4 plus IX dot sigma to the exponent nu, where
x1, x2, x3, and x4 are four-dimensional Euclidean space. So A is like the Euclidean time, and B is like going to become, becomes the Euclidean space coordinates, and x hat mu is equal to each of these x's divided by the length of Euclidean space, which is x mu over the square root of x1 squared plus x2 squared plus x3 squared plus x4 squared. So this, so u nu will also map S3, 3 sphere at infinity in R4 into S3, which is the group SU2. It takes points in space at large R in Euclidean space and maps them into group elements, like so. And this winding number, I'll write it here and then raise it up so you can see it. This winding number turns out to be 1 over 24 pi squared times the integral of d cubed s times the trace of epsilon ijk of u du inverse for I, for j, and for k. So in other words, if you, so this term is to SU2 what that thing over there is to U1, and if you shove in this expression for all the winding numbers and calculate it, well, if you plug this U nu into this formula and calculate it out, you'll discover that all of these exponents and the identities of the polys cancel everything out except for a term linear and nu times 24 pi squared. And this S3 is the integral over the 3-sphere, over all the angles of the 3-sphere. So it has two properties. Nu goes to nu if you make a small change in U. So if you give me some function that maps the 3-sphere into SU2, and then I deform that by some other function whose condition is such that it, I can continuously deform delta U to zero, then nu will stay the same for both of these functions. And it is additive. So the product of nu, if you write u as the product of u nu 1 times u nu 2, then this nu will be the sum of nu 1 and nu 2. And it's not actually hard to show that this is 1 over 16 pi squared d4x times the trace of FF dual. So it's the Pontryagin number. Now I'm really trying to cram too much on the board, I suppose. So that I'm not going to show, but the reasoning is the same as here. You shove in, you recognize that u du inverse is equal to the limit of the gauge field by what's up there, and then you could use Gauss's theorem to manipulate this into derivatives of gauge fields with their commutator, and you will indeed recover that. So it's more arithmetically tedious to do it for SU2, but it's actually not all that difficult. So what if it's not SU2? If it's not SU2, then it turns out we have the same thing. In other words, the winding number for any group turns out to be given by the integral of the trace of FF dual in Euclidean 4 space for any simple Lie group. So for U1, you don't get anything here because U1 isn't simple. In fact, U1 group will map the free sphere into a circle, but there are no topologically non-trivial ways of doing that. Whereas here, for SU2, you're mapping a free sphere onto another free sphere. So you can wrap the free sphere once, twice, thrice, many times around itself. It turns out for any other group, this is a theorem due to Raoul Bott. That I am not going to prove, but basically it comes about from the fact that any simple Lie group has an SU2 inside it. I mean, they have many SU2s, but any simple Lie group has an SU2 inside it, and that is enough to give you a winding number for that group. So if it's a product, so if G is a product, simple groups times abelian, then the abelian parts don't make contribution, and you get a winding number for every simple group. So if you have SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, SU3 will have a winding number, and SU2 will have another winding number, and this will not have a winding number in Euclidean 4 space. U1 has a winding number in Euclidean 2 space, but it does not have one in Euclidean 4 space. It's because you can take an elastic band on a sphere and just deform it to zero. But you can't take an elastic band on an infinite pole and one that's twisted on an infinite pole and continuously deform them into each other. No matter how you slide it up or down, you'll never escape the pole. Right? That's the idea. So what about instantons? What about instantons? Well, if I want to know the vacuum-to-vacuum transition, which is the limit as T goes to infinity of this quantity here, then this will be given by the path integral over all configurations of A of the exponential of that classical action, which is the integral of d4x times 1 over 2g squared times the trace of that product of f, plus terms that fix the gauge. And did you ever take path integral formula? Are you familiar with gauge fixing terms from QFT? Right? So the idea is that if I add up over all gauge configurations, without these terms, I overcount because there could be two different paths that I think are different, but they're actually the same up to a gauge transformation. So that means I don't want to count that path more than once. I only want to count the paths that are gauge inequivalent. And so there are various methods for doing that. So I should put that our gauge inequivalent, if you like. But once I gauge fix, that doesn't matter, and then I can add up over all the paths. So either I gauge fix or I have to factor out the equivalent paths. But now the trouble is that because of this winding number feature, this path integral means I've got a sum over all of nu. So the real path integral is actually that, where a nu denotes the winding number of this configuration. All right, well, so what? Well, suppose the state that we are interested in the gauge theory is the vacuum as t goes to negative infinity. This means that the field strength goes to zero at negative infinity. And suppose the state is the vacuum as t goes to plus infinity. Well, then, of course, the same thing has to happen. It's also got to be a state of vanishing f. Well, this means that together these things mean that a mu must approach a pure gauge configuration, which is u inverse d mu nu as t goes to negative infinity, but it will be some other gauge transformation as t goes to plus infinity. And the point is, the winding number of this does not have to be the same as the winding number of that. Yes?
I think I missed the logic a little bit. Where is the sum on these winding numbers coming from?
It's coming from this. It's coming from the fact that I have to add up over all the inequivalent gauge inequivalent fields. A gauge field with one winding number is not gauge equivalent locally to a field with another winding number, so I have to add up over all these possibilities. They're not the same thing. The same would be true for an abelian field in 2D space. If my gauge field approaches something with a winding number of 3, and I have another gauge field that approaches something with a winding number of 8, I cannot change them into each other. It's just not possible. That's what this is about. So if I really want to add up over all possibilities to discover what the vacuum is doing, that's what I should do. I could ask the question, all right, what if I go to a vacuum with the same winding number? Then, of course, I would fix the winding number and I wouldn't do this sum. But if all I require is this, vacuum to vacuum, then in general, I could get a change in the winding number. I could get delta nu is equal to nu at t equals plus infinity minus nu at t equals negative infinity. And that will equal the difference between, I guess I shouldn't have raised that. So that will be, there we are, that will be the difference between these two actions with the same winding number, and maybe I'll write it up over here, that will be equal to the integral of 1 over 1 over 16 pi squared of the integral of ds mu of this epsilon mu nu rho beta of 2/3 of the trace of 3 a's. Which is this thing we have over there, the integral of d4x of the trace of f dual. So this thing is that formula right there. At large R, remember this is at large R, so at large R, this and this are gauge fields, and if I write that integral as a surface integral in four space, then the fourth direction dots into the epsilon to make it a 3D epsilon, and then by Gauss's theorem, this integrates back to that trace of, trace of FF dual. So the idea is there will be some discrete infinity of vacuum states. Some discrete infinity of vacua that in general, they will be labeled by an integer. So we'll call it n, say. And so I can consider, just a sec, let me write this and then I'll get to it. I can consider the following transition from one kind of vacuum to another. Yes?
I'm sorry, I'm finding the last line a little bit confusing. Delta V is the difference between two winding numbers, right?
Yeah.
And but the winding numbers are defined to be in terms of the pointer angular class.
That's right.
But
so
here you've got.
So I should, if you want to think of, let's imagine this has winding number zero. I'll take that to have winding number zero and the other one to be winding number something else, in which case I will get that. But you're right, if I take two different winding numbers, I'll have two different A's. So I meant to say what happens if this has trivial winding number and this does not.
All right.
Sorry.
Yeah. I think I'm missing the basic thing here. So these vacua are meant to be distinct.
Well, these M's are meant to be distinct, yes.
Okay.
That each A, this does not have to equal that. So suppose that's trivial, which is this one, and this is not, I get it. But in general, this could have one winding number, this could have another, yes.
But in that expression, the two zero states, are they the same state? Or
well, they're not. That's the whole point. We think superficially, we think they are. The whole point of this argument is they are not the same. They are labeled by these things. And so if I really want to have a vacuum-to-vacuum transition, I've got to consider this structure, yeah.
If these states are locally, these vacuum states are locally indistinguishable, how can we tell the difference between them?
Well, that's the problem. We can't. So that's what I'm going to get to. That's a very good question. We can't tell them. We don't know how to tell them apart. So let's see how we get to that point and what the consequences are. Okay? So this will be the integral, the path integral of dA mu, where nu is going to be this difference in winding numbers. Remember, nu is additive. So if I have the nu for two different u's, I could have written this as the product of a's with the difference of the winding numbers and do that, but I was a bit sloppy. So it's easier to think of this as no winding number and some winding number. So this, so I'm going to add up only over those a's that have this particular winding number, and I'll have e to the minus, the integral, of course, of the Lagrangian of A plus the gauge fixing part, d4x. And so if I add up only over all those gauge fields that have a specific winding number, that's telling me the amplitude to go from one vacuum to a vacuum that has the other winding number, either 0 to nu or m to n, as the case may be. So if nu equals 0, then we have this transition that the winding number does not change, and this implies that S of A will equal 0. Or S of A bar will equal 0. If n goes to some other winding number, then this will not be 0. and it will make a contribution to the action. So this is where the instanton comes from. Because this is a vacuum. It has zero energy. This is another vacuum. It has zero energy. So you've got to transition from some zero energy thing to a different zero energy thing. So you need an instanton. You've got a tunnel from a state that has the same starting energy as finishing energy. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. So I'm a little confused about the measure there. Are we saying we're not summing over all possible nukes?
For this particular case, no. What I jumped ahead of myself, in general, maybe I should get rid of this here. In general, we're going to do the sum. So I was writing what's going to happen. But if I fix this step winding number zero and that, then what I'm really doing is this. But what will happen because of this instanton feature is we'll have to add them all up. That's what I want to do, I hope, within 5 minutes.
I see. So
okay. Yeah. So, so the true vacuum is not n equals zero. What the heck is it? Well, let's imagine a gauge transformation, a large gauge transformation, as it's called, that will take, that will map, let's call it T, and then let's have T maps N, or T acts on N, and it raises this winding number by one. And there is a form for that. It's equal to, there's a form for that. It's equal to the exponential of 2 pi I times the integral of D2S dotted into the Yang-Mills electric field as a function of x hat evaluated at infinity. And one can show if nu equals 1. So T commutes with the Hamiltonian. And if I look at what an eigenstate is, T acting on some eigenstate, let's call it theta, will have to be some phase times theta, which means theta will in general be some linear combination of all the vacua with all the different winding numbers from n equals minus infinity to infinity. H of theta has to be zero because it's the vacuum. And so the true ground state should be, in general, this state. There's no reason to prefer any one vacuum over any other vacuum. And if you act with T on this, each N increments by one, but because you've got an infinite sum, you resum the series, and that pulls a theta, an e to the I theta, sorry, out in front of this. You can show, I'm going to cheat and go here because I don't want to raise and rub the boards off. You can show that if I have two different thetas, suppose I put a different parameter in here. Theta is some real number, it's a parameter. Suppose I ask, okay, what is the transition amplitude when I have some parameter theta? So it's a parameter that tells me what kind of vacuum I have, hence the name. So suppose I choose a theta vacuum and somebody else chooses a theta prime vacuum, you can show that these vacua are distinct. Now I see the disadvantage of working here. These vacua are distinct, and you can show, in fact, that it's the integral of the Lagrangian plus the gauge fixing term plus I theta over 16 pi squared times the trace of F dual. So in other words, you get nothing unless these two thetas are equal. So the theta vacua are distinct. The theta vacua are distinct, and what that means or implies is that the action that we thought is the one we should write down that's the most general, one more thing and then I'll get to the question, is actually the integral of d4x times minus 1 over 4 g squared fa mu nu, fa mu nu, if I wick rotate back, plus theta over 32 pi squared fa mu nu f dual a mu. So that QCD thing, you might, FF dual is a total derivative, and you might think, why include it? It has no effect on the equations of motion. That is correct, but in the path integral, it will affect the equations. Yes?
So why did we assume that the eigenvalue of the T operator was e to the power I theta? Is that because it's a...
Because you can show from the form of this vacuum that this is the only possible parameter. So let's see, I skipped over that, but if I write, in general, the eigenstate will be a linear combination of these things. And then you can add, so if you want to show why it looks like this.
I think I understand that.
Yeah, so the way to do it, right, is just write theta as some arbitrary linear combination of these, with this rule, and then demand that T of theta is lambda theta, then you can show that lambda must be e to the I theta according to that rule.
I guess T is an element of SU2, therefore its eigenvalues has to be phases, right?
Yeah, that's another way of looking at it. But even if you didn't know it, this rule plus T of theta is lambda theta will force that on you.
About the definition of the T operator over there. What is E?
E is the electric field associated with the Yang-Mills field. Let me raise this up.
Yeah, it's okay.
EA is F0I. Or rather, EIA is F0I, where that's the Yang-Mills field. The I components, the Yang-Mills analog of the electric field. So what happens now is that this is a new parameter in the standard model. So here's some beyond the standard model for topological reasons that you might think, I don't need this term at all because it's a total derivative. But in fact, we do in the path integral. This characterizes whatever the vacuum is that we live in this world. But then you might think, well, all right, so what? It's a silly thing, but why should I care? Because this is still a total derivative and it can't do anything interesting in physics. Well, the answer to that is that's not right. And what I guess I'll do next time is show how that quantity percolates into actual physical things that people can measure. And it leaves us, what we will find is this does have an empirical thumbprint, and our experiments tell us this is a very, very, very tiny number. We have no idea why at this point in history. It It just is tiny. We live in a universe where this is tiny. Maybe it's even zero, but we don't know why. We have nothing theoretically telling us the value this number must have. And that is where we are circa 2014. So maybe one of you will figure out why it has the value it does or come up with an explanation. But this is another tuned parameter in the standard model. Typically ignored, but it does exist.
Axions?
Sorry?
Axions?
Well, yeah, so one, that's all mentioned next time. One way people have thought of dealing with this is let's make this small due to some symmetry breaking effect, but that forces the introduction of a new particle, and the name of that particle has been called the axion, and all of that's all well and good, except no one's ever seen an axion. All we can say is where it isn't. We don't know where it is. There's a lot of stuff ruled out about axions, and there are constraints. If they exist and they couple too powerfully to standard model stuff, the sun will burn out too quickly, and none of us would be here. So that puts bounds on the axion lifetime, axion mass, and so on. But the only idea people have for dealing with why that's small is the axion. But in my view, it's a lump under the rug. Okay, I solve why theta is small, up pops the axion until we see it. You know, then you've got to argue epistemically what's better. I don't know. Or other ideas, maybe some other idea, right? I mean, there's nothing sacred about an axion at this point in history because we don't have any evidence it exists. Unless you count that as evidence. Okay, so tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock.
Yes.